Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, November 9th, 2022. Midterm elections yielding no decision yet about which party will control the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate. In the House, a few dozen races still to be called, and the vote counting does continue. And in the Senate, the tally now stands at 48 Democratic seats, 49 Republican seats, and three undecided races in Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada. And that one in Georgia, state officials today saying there will be a runoff election in early December because neither candidate will likely get over 50% of the vote. Coming up, reaction to the election results from President Joe Biden, the House Republican Conference Chair, Elise Stefanik, and the chair of the House Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Sean Patrick Maloney, who lost his own reelection. We'll also talk about the races with Washington Post reporter John Wagner. Also today, Supreme Court hearing a case challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act and the portion that says that Native American children up for adoption or to be placed in foster care should be placed with Native American families if possible. We'll hear some of the oral argument before the justices and talk about the case with Vox Supreme Court reporter Ian Millhiser. And now to the day after Election Day. Associated Press writing that Republicans were closing in Wednesday on a narrow House majority, while control of the Senate hinged on tight Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia races in a midterm election that defied expectations of sweeping conservative victories driven by frustration over inflation and President Joe Biden's leadership. That was the lead paragraph from the AP story. President Biden at the White House reacting to the results and the races still to be called.
Well, we had an election yesterday. And it was a good day, I think, for democracy. And I think it was a good day for America. Excuse me, I have a little hoarse. Our democracy has been tested in recent years, but with their votes, the American people have spoken and proven once again that democracy is who we are. The states across the country saw a record voter turnout, and the heart and soul of our democracy, the voters, the poll workers, the election officials, they did their job and they fulfilled their duty, and apparently without much interference at all, without any interference, it looks like. And that's a testament, I think, to the American people. While we don't know all the results yet, at least I don't know them all yet, here's what we do know. While the press and the pundits are predicting a giant red wave, it didn't happen. And I know you were somewhat miffed by my obsessive optimism, but I felt good during the whole process. I thought we were going to do fine. While any seat lost is painful, some good Democrats didn't win the last night. Democrats had a strong night. And we lost fewer seats in the House of Representatives than any Democratic president's first midterm election in the last 40 years. And we had the best midterm for governors since 1986. And another thing that we know is that voters spoke clearly about their concerns, about raising costs, the rising costs that they're in, and the need to get inflation down. There's still a lot of people hurting. They're very concerned. And it's about crime and public safety. And they sent a clear and unmistakable message that they want to preserve our democracy and protect the right to choose in this country. And I especially want to thank the young people of this nation, who I'm told, I haven't seen the numbers, voted historic numbers again, and just as they did 2 years ago. And they voted to continue addressing the climate crisis, gun violence, their personal rights and freedoms, and the student debt relief.
President Biden, part of his opening statement at his news conference at the White House today, he said that he understands the frustration of voters, that he gets it. The first question from Zeke Miller of the Associated Press was, if that's true, what changes now?
You mentioned that Americans are frustrated, and in fact, 75% of voters say the country is heading into the wrong direction despite the results of last night. What in the next 2 years do you intend to do differently to change people's opinion of the direction of the country, particularly as you contemplate a run for president in 2024?
Nothing, because they're just finding out what we're doing. The more they know about what we're doing, the more support there is. Do you know anybody who wants us to get rid of the change we made on prescription drug prices and raise prices again? Do you know anybody who wants us to walk away from building those roads and bridges and the internet and so on? I don't know any. I think that the problem is the major piece of legislation we passed, and some of it bipartisan, takes time to be recognized. For example, you got over $1 trillion worth of infrastructure money, but not that many spades have been put in the ground. It's taking time. For example, I was on the phone congratulating a Californian recently, and then someone in up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the congressman who got elected. He said, can you help us make sure we're able to have high-speed rail service from Scranton to New York City? I said, yeah, we can. First of all, it'll make it a lot easier, take a lot of vehicles off the road, and we have more money in the pot now, already out there, we voted for, than the entire money we spent on Amtrak to begin with. And it's the same way. For example, I talked about through the campaign that we're going to limit the cost of insulin for seniors to $35 a month instead of $400 a month. Well, it doesn't take effect till next year. So there's a lot of things that are just starting to kick in. And the same way with what we've done in terms of the environmental stuff. It takes time to get it moving. So I'm not going to change. As a matter of fact, you know, there's some things I want to change and add to. For example, we passed the most extensive gun legislation, rational gun policy in 30 years. But we didn't ban assault weapons. I'm going to ban assault weapons. They're going to try like the devil. So I'm not going to change the direction. I said I ran for three reasons. I'm going to continue to stay where I am. And I know I fully understand the legitimate concern that what I'm saying is wrong, okay? One is that I said we're going to restore the soul of the country, begin to treat each other with decency, honor, and integrity. And it's starting to happen. People are the conversations are becoming more normal, becoming more, how can I say it, decent. Second thing I said was I want to build a country from the middle out, the bottom up, and that way everybody does fine. I'm tired of trickle down. Not a whole lot trickles down when you trickle down to hardworking folks. And the third thing I know is still very hard. I'm going to do everything in my power to see through to unite the country. It's hard to sustain yourself as a leading democracy in the world if you can't generate some unity. So I'm not going to change anything in any fundamental way.
President Biden, news conference at the White House, ran about 50 minutes or so. We covered it live on C-SPAN Radio, and it is available in its entirety on our website at cspan.org. One of the high-profile Senate races that was uncalled on Tuesday night has now been called this Wednesday. In Wisconsin, incumbent Senator Ron Johnson, Republican, winning re-election over Democratic opponent, the Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, by 1 point. It's 50.5% to 49.5%. From thehill.com, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, told reporters at the Capitol Wednesday morning that he is feeling good after Democrats won retiring Senator Pat Toomey's seat in Pennsylvania, Republican, giving them a better chance of keeping their Senate majority. And as things stand now, Democrats control 48 Senate seats and Republicans control 49. Democrats could keep control of the majority in an evenly divided Senate, as Vice President Harris has the power to cast tie-breaking votes. While the win in Pennsylvania makes it more likely that Senator Schumer will serve another term as Majority Leader, battle for control of Congress is still far from decided, with ballots in Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada still being counted. That from The Hill. The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, about 2 a.m. into Wednesday morning Eastern Time, spoke to his supporters in Washington saying, "You're out late, but when you wake up tomorrow, we will be in the majority and Nancy Pelosi will be in the minority. The American people are ready for a majority that offer a new direction." Republicans need 5 seats to gain a majority in the House, and Kevin McCarthy could be the new House Speaker. He officially launched his bid today, and the current House Republican whip, Steve Scalise, also announced for the seat that would be below Speaker should they get the majority. That would be the Majority Leader. And Steve Scalise telling Fox News that he will not challenge Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. There was some speculation in the media that Steve Scalise might. At the time Congressman McCarthy spoke early Wednesday morning, there were still about 70 House races to be called. And as of now, according to the Associated Press results, C-SPAN.org, Democrats have 182 seats. Republicans have 206. 218 is a majority, so there are still a lot of races to be called, but it's below that 70 mark. The House Republican Conference Chair, Elise Stefanik of New York, interviewed today on Newsmax.
Congresswoman, I just want to talk about where the party goes from here. Is there a shakeup in leadership? Is Kevin McCarthy the next Speaker of the House? Byron Donalds is challenging you in leadership. What happens next?
Well, I strongly support Kevin McCarthy for Speaker, and I'm running for re-election as House Republican Conference Chair. We successfully unified Republicans, and we're going to win back the House and fire Nancy Pelosi once and for all. My two top priorities when it comes to political and delivering this House flip to fire Nancy Pelosi and save America, we swept in these New York races. We could win the majority in New York alone. We picked up four seats and held all of our Republicans. And this is a state like New York. No one in the mainstream media saw that coming. We won two in the Hudson Valley. We picked up two on Long Island. In addition, the number of Republican women that I've worked to recruit and invest in, that is going to be how we build our historic majority. Mm-hmm. And I have overwhelming support from my colleagues, which is, you know, who I work with as the House Republican Conference Chair. And I'm honored to have the support of President Trump as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Just final question for you. The numbers, we're still getting numbers into the newsroom every hour here. How does it play out in the House? What is the majority? Somewhere in the 220s? For the Republicans?
Well, I think it's important to note, I believe we will have a bigger majority than Nancy Pelosi. And let's look back at our nation's history. There's only three times in modern history that House Republicans have won back the House. So this is a historic win. We promised the American people we would flip the House and fire Nancy Pelosi. And we are going to do just that. As I said, we will build that majority just out of New York State alone. And you have seats that have yet to be called that I think are going to fall our way, like in Connecticut, a state that has not had a Republican member of Congress, certainly in the last decade. Florida, we picked up four seats as well. Texas, we picked up seats. We picked up seats on the southern border in South Texas. In Oregon, we're going to pick up a seat. So there is bright news here. Miami-Dade flipping to Republican. There are bright spots, and it's important to highlight those, but we will have a larger majority than Nancy Pelosi.
Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Republican from New York, the Republican Conference Chair, interviewed on Newsmax this morning. She won re-election on Tuesday, defeating Democrat Matt Catelli 59% to 41%. Another congressman, also from New York, a Democrat, also in his party's House leadership, did not win. Sean Patrick Maloney chairs the DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the group in charge of recruiting Democratic House candidates, then raising and spending money to get them elected. Congressman Maloney beaten by Republican Michael Lawler 51 to 49%. Congressman Maloney speaking in Washington today about his race and the continuing battle for a House majority.
A short while ago, I spoke to my opponent, Michael Lawler, and congratulated him on a good win. And I pledged my support to him in transitioning this congressional seat so that the people we serve in the Hudson Valley don't have any interruption in the service they deserve. I also just took a call from the president and expressed our appreciation for his leadership on the issues that matter to the American people. And I said to him what I hope every American will see, that last night, House Democrats stood our ground. And we believe November 8th, 2022 will be a signature date in American political history. And we hope the high watermark of some of the anger and the division that we have dealt with this entire cycle from January 6th on through. And we hope for something better for our country, because that's what all Americans deserve. We are still working, and any fair person and responsible observer should understand that it will take time to understand all of the races and their outcomes. I just told you what happened in mine, and we will tell you what happens in each of them, fairly and honestly and transparently. But we don't know yet what the outcome will be in, at a minimum, couple dozen races. And we don't know where the dust will settle. But I can tell you there's going to be a two handle on it, and probably a lot better than that. And as we sit here, I can't, with 100% certainty, tell you who holds the House majority. But I will leave it to others to make predictions. We're going to do it the right way. And if we fall a little short, we're going to know that we gave it our all and we beat the spread. And I want to thank our candidates, who were remarkable, whose hard work and dedication fueled the defense that defines what happened last night. I want to thank all of our volunteers, all of our donors, all the people who believed in us, who read that we didn't have a chance and went to work anyway. In this life, how you handle defeat is as important as how you handle success. And we had an equal measure of both last night.
Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, Democrat from New York, chair of the DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, at a news conference today in Washington, D.C., Congressman conceding the loss in his own reelection bid. John Wagner is a national political breaking news reporter for The Washington Post, who has been tracking everything that is election-related, joining us now by phone. Thank you very much. The headline when we woke up today, Democrats did better than expected. That brings up two questions. Why, and were the polls wrong? Let's start with the why. What have we learned?
Well, one thing we learned is that a lot of Democrats are performing better than would be suggested by President Biden's approval ratings. And I think that's something that took a lot of pundits by surprise. And a lot of it is, you know, a lot of these races have some local flavor, some, you know, even statewide have issues that are not necessarily something that affect the presidency day to day. And you also have a lot of candidates, particularly in the Senate, that have individual shortcomings or individual things about them that make them outstanding. And I think that factored in as well.
Do we have any exit polls on which issues were dominant?
Well, it was interesting, as you know, it would surprise no one, but you know, the economy and inflation in particular were salient issues. But so is abortion, which you know generally has cut in favor of Democrats, whereas the economy cuts in favor of Republicans. So you had these cross currents that I think helped lead to some of the more unpredictable results.
And on those polls that were predicting that the Democrats would get wiped out, did they miss something?
Well, certainly if you look at the Senate races, a lot of the polls, you know, we saw toward the end were within the margin of error. And a lot of these races really have come down to the wire and were very tight. So several of them, you know, could have gone either way. A couple of them are still unresolved. And so I'm not sure you can fault the polling so much in the Senate races. And even the generic ballot on the House side was pretty close heading into the final day. So I think there's a lot of punditry in the way that the polls were read, but I'm not sure that the polls themselves can be faulted.
Also a lot of concerns pre-election day that results would get tied up in claims of widespread voter fraud. There's also some concerns about actual violence. Looking at what happened on Tuesday, what's the analysis of that?
Well, things seem to have gone pretty smoothly. I mean, there are always glitches of some sort or another, but nothing, you know, that would seem to wholesale put results at risk. And one thing I think that's been interesting today to watch is, you know, a lot of the candidates who denied the results of the 2020 presidential election, who went on to lose Tuesday, were conceding, and in some cases conceding rather graciously today. So it does not seem to be the worst case scenario that some envisioned about, you know, whether people would accept election results.
You have been tracking the elections, all the detailed things going by your desk. Did anything surprise you?
Well, you know, there is a scenario right now that Democrats could actually pick up a net of one seat in the Senate when all is said and done. We won't know now, and apparently until December 6th, when the runoff is held in the Georgia Senate race. But, the way it looks now, we're either going to have, you know, assuming Warnock can pull that off, you'll have either a 50-50 Senate, or possibly the Democrats could have 51 seats if Catherine Cortez Masto pulls out the race in Nevada. The latest results have her running a little behind Adam Laxalt, but the way our analysts are looking at it, a lot of the remaining vote that hasn't been counted should favor her. So that one's still too close to call.
Turnout higher than in the previous midterms. What might account for that?
Well, I do think there were a lot of, you know, motivating issues on both sides. You know, we talked about abortion, which has been something that's resonated with Democrats. And, you know, everyone is feeling the economy one way or another, whether it's inflation, whether it's seeing, you know, a turbulent stock market. And I think that's, you know, accounts for some of what we've seen in terms of driving people to the polls.
John Wagner is a national political breaking news reporter for The Washington Post. His work at WashingtonPost.com and on Twitter, it's at WP John Wagner. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
The Georgia Secretary of State's Chief Operating Officer Gabriel Sterling tweeting this morning, while county officials are still doing the detailed work on counting the votes, we feel it is safe to say that there will be a runoff for the U.S. Senate here in Georgia slated for December 6th. That runoff would be between Senator Raphael Warnock, Democratic incumbent, and Republican challenger Herschel Walker. Under Georgia state rules, if neither of the candidates wins more than 50% of the vote, then the top two people in a race go to a runoff. And there's a third candidate in this race, Libertarian Chase Oliver, getting about 2% of the vote, dragging both of the other candidates under that 50%. The Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who oversees state elections and fresh off his own reelection victory, speaking about the voting on Tuesday, the counting, and this upcoming Senate runoff. He was at a news conference at the Capitol building in Atlanta.
Most of the races have a clear winner. In fact, Bea Wynn and I spoke last night, and she graciously conceded. And I thank her for that. That's the way it's supposed to be. We need all candidates who come up short to acknowledge it and to come back and fight within our system another day if that's their so choice. There is one race in our state that is going to be moving to the December 6th runoff. That is the race for the United States Senate between Senator Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker. Our office has already begun the behind-scenes work to start building the ballots. So ballots are being built as we speak, and counties are making preparations. So some specifics for the process. Voters can request absentee ballots now through Monday, November 28th. There are about 150,000 voters who will receive an absentee ballot because they are on our absentee ballot rollover list. These people are either 65 or they're disabled. Our absentee ballot request portal is now open. Early voting must begin no later than Monday, November 28th in all counties. We do anticipate that some counties may likely have Saturday voting following Thanksgiving, as well as on November 26th. We are working with the counties to find out what their plans are on this front and as soon as possible so that their voters can make the best plans. This will be a very heavy lift for our counties because it's a four-week runoff period, but I have confidence they will take all the measures required to rise to the task. While we are working preparing for the runoff, we all have our obligation to close out the November 8th election. Counties must certify by Tuesday, November 15th, by 5 p.m. Then we move to the risk-limiting audit. We will, quote, roll the dice, so to speak, on Wednesday, November 16th. Then the audit must be complete by November 22nd. And the state must certify by Friday the 25th. That's the day after Thanksgiving. It's a lot of work, but that's how the machinery of our democratic republic works. We welcome it because we know at the end of the day, everyone wants to know that we have honest and fair elections, and we do.
Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, holding a news conference in Atlanta this morning. Former President Donald Trump posting online today, while in certain ways yesterday's election was somewhat disappointing, from my personal standpoint, it was a very big victory. 219 wins and 16 losses in the general. Who has ever done better than that? Former President Trump also interviewed by Fox News Digital and asked whether he would be changing his plans to make a very big announcement, as he said, next Tuesday, speculation that he would be running for president in 2024. He told the outlet Fox News Digital, "We had tremendous success. Why would anything change?" Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, also a Republican with a re-election victory on Tuesday, defeating Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist 59% to 40%. And that victory, writes NBC, could become a springboard for a White House run and put him on a collision course with former President Donald Trump. By the way, President Joe Biden asked today which one that he would like to meet in a general election, and he responded, "It will be fun watching them take on each other." But that's all in the future. Today, Governor DeSantis preparing for another major storm heading towards his state, a state that's still recovering from a recent hurricane. Governor saying the tropical storm Nicole is closing in and it's strengthening.
Winds and storm surge will contribute to continued beach erosion in areas that have already seen erosion from Hurricane Ian. The wind field from the storm is very large, and we expect impacts to stretch far beyond the center track, including tropical storm force winds as far north as Jacksonville. Winds are the main concern with Nicole, but we also expect to see some heavy rains, the potential for flash flooding, and 3 to 5 feet of storm surge in some areas. Palm Beach, Martin, St. Lucie, Indian River, Brevard, and Volusia counties are currently under a hurricane warning. 49 additional counties are under tropical storm watches or warnings. Evacuation orders have been issued at the county level on the east coast of Florida and in counties including Brevard, Flagler, Martin, Palm Beach, St. John, St. Lucie, and Volusia counties. Obviously, that is zone specific, so make sure you know your zone and pay attention and listen to the local officials. People in the impacted areas should continue to pay close attention as the storm progresses. I think we know these things can be dynamic, and so please exercise that diligence. For those under evacuation orders, remember, you don't need to go hundreds of miles away. Instead, you can go tens of miles inland, stay within the state, and still be safe. Now, we're ready. We have more than enough resources to respond to this storm. On Monday, I declared a state of emergency for 34 counties so that communities had ample time to prepare for the storm. Kevin and his team have been in constant communication with both utility and fuel industry partners, including FPL, Duke Energy, TECO, municipal electric providers, and rural electric co-ops. There are 16,000 linemen staged to immediately begin power restoration efforts, and Floridians in the path the storm should expect, you know, to see power outages when you're having these gusty conditions. There'll be debris, you know, that will affect power lines and the transmission lines. And so should just be prepared for that.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican at the Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee. If Tropical Storm Nicole makes landfall as a Category 1 hurricane as projected, it would be the first November hurricane to hit the United States in 37 years. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 646, NASDAQ down 263, S&P down 79. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. A few more headlines. U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner's legal team says that she's been sent to a penal colony in Russia to serve out her 9-year sentence for drug possession. A sentence that stems from vape canisters with cannabis oil found in her luggage earlier this year as she passed through a Moscow airport. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tweeting, "Following a sham trial and the unjust sentencing of Brittany Griner, Moscow is transferring her from a prison in Moscow to a remote penal colony. It is another injustice layered on her ongoing unjust and wrongful detention." And President Biden, at a news conference at the White House, says that he hopes the Russian President Vladimir Putin will now talk more seriously about a prisoner exchange for Brittany Griner now that the U.S. elections are over. And Russia's military announcing it is withdrawing from Ukraine's southern city of Kherson and nearby areas as Ukrainian forces are moving in. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has suggested that the Russians were pretending to pull out from that city in order to lure the Ukrainian army into a fight on favorable terms for the Russian forces. U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral arguments in a case that challenges a federal law that says when placing Native American children in foster care or in permanent homes for adoption, the preference should be with Native American families. It's the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. The case is Holland v. Brackeen. Coming up, we'll talk with a Supreme Court reporter from Vox. First, some of the oral argument today. Justice Elena Kagan questioning attorney Matthew Dempsey McGill, representing the family that sued.
Congress is very clear in this statute that it thinks that this statute is critical to the continuing existence of the tribe as a political entity. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons it passes this statute, is the political entity is itself being threatened because of the way decisions on the placement of children are being made. So I guess I can't imagine a statute that's more wrapped up, given the terms and given what we know about what Congress was doing, is more wrapped up in the continued flourishment of political communities.
Your Honor, the placement preferences do not affect tribal membership. You can be a member of the tribe wherever you are placed. And it is, you know, the fact that tribes often do unilaterally enroll children, regardless of where they are placed. The further point I would make, Your Honor, is that embedded in the question is a premise that tribes have a proprietary interest in these children. And I have to reject that premise.
Well, this is Congress's understanding of what it was doing. You know, and again, this goes back to Justice Gorsuch's view of you can question the policy, you cannot question the policy, but the policy is for Congresses to make. And Congress understood these children's placement decisions as integral to the continued thriving of Indian communities. And Congress had a different view of the costs and benefits of how these decisions were being made. And that's not something that we can second guess, is it?
It is under the Constitution, Your Honor. I think the Congress does not have the power to treat these children as property of the tribes because of their ancestry.
We can second guess things under the Constitution if you have made a case about an equal protection violation or some other constitutional violation. But what I'm suggesting is that just the idea of standing up there and saying this has nothing to do with the continued thriving of Indian political communities, that's a judgment for Congress to make.
I want to be clear about this. There was a real problem that Congress was trying to address. We're not denying that there the existence of a problem, but the means Congress chose are impermissible. Two wrongs do not make a right here.
Attorney Matthew Dempsey McGill at today's Supreme Court oral argument. Questions from the Justice Elena Kagan. The case is Holland v. Brackeen. The U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Needler advocated for keeping the current law and its provisions. Here are questions from Justice Samuel Alito about how far Congress's power extends in this area.
What about the boarding school law? Congress had the power to do that?
Congress had the power at the time, I think.
Well, if it were to do it, if it were to do it tomorrow, would that fall outside Congress's plenary power?
Well, it has to be the plenary power. I think there are at least two things to bear in mind about this. I think Congress, when dealing with a tribe in its political capacity, has a great deal of power to diminish the tribe's or regulate the tribe's exercise of its governmental authority, like under the Indian Civil Rights Act, et cetera. That's dealing with the tribes as tribes in a political capacity. I think where Congress is addressing the protections for individual Indians, either children, adults, whoever, then that's what triggers the formulation of the trust responsibility or the dependent status of tribes. It has to be reasonably related to Congress's unique obligations,
right. Could Indians, Congress,
which means it has to be protective, not harming.
Could Can Congress enact a law that alters the substantive law that states apply in areas like contracts or torts or rules of evidence when one of the parties in the case is an Indian?
I think the mere fact that the party is an Indian would probably not be sufficient.
Why? Why isn't that rationally related to furthering the interests of Indians?
I think in examining any hypothetical statute or context, it is necessary to look at the judgment that Congress made and to know why Congress made the judgment that it did. In Indian contracts, for example, there were many, many years where contracts by individual Indians were not valid unless approved by the Secretary of the Interior because of a concern that they were going to be taken advantage of. So if there was that sort of justification, and presumably, I don't think we can assume Congress would act in an arbitrary manner. It would be addressing a real-world problem in a practical way.
No, I understand it. And
no, go ahead.
Just one more. Honestly, I don't know how to analyze this question because if plenary means everything, then it means everything. And otherwise, what I've gotten from the briefs and the arguments is that we have to try to extract certain rules from our cases, which quite honestly strike me as a mishmash.
Samuel Alito, Supreme Court Justice, questioning U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Kneeler. Ian Millhiser is a senior correspondent at Vox Media covering the Supreme Court and the Constitution. He's been following today's case, and he joins us now by phone. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
From the oral argument, which way might the court be leaning on this question of requiring tribal eligible children in foster care or up for adoption be placed with the tribal families whenever possible?
So it's a good question, and I don't know that I can give a confident answer about that. It's a 6-3 court, 6 Republicans, 3 Democrats, but Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, tends to vote with the liberals on questions involving Indian affairs, and his questions today suggested that he will continue that pattern. Amy Coney Barrett has been emerged as a bit of a swing vote in these sorts of cases, and what I heard from her today is that she may strike down some, but probably won't vote to strike down all of the law. If the case gets any traction, the thing that, you know, the most conservative justices seem to get the most, seem most concerned about was they thought that this law discriminates on the basis of race. I think that they are wrong about that for a lot of reasons, but they seem to view this as just, well, why are you treating Native American children different than other children? And weren't as interested in some of the nuances of the case as some of their colleagues were.
On that issue of race, and we should mention this is the second case in just a couple of weeks where the court has dealt with a question of race, what is the history of Native Americans being treated as a racial group or a political class?
Right. So this law, I will note that it does not use the term Native Americans. It uses the term Indians, which we tend to think of as an antiquated term, but there's actually a good reason for that, which is that the law does not say anything about how Native American children should be treated. It says that if a child is the child of an Indian and they are eligible for membership in an Indian tribe, then certain rules apply regarding who they should be placed with if they need to be moved to another family. The reason why the law is written that way is because tribes are separate nations, you know, in the same way that, like, France is a separate nation. You know, they are nations that the United States makes treaties with, and they have a right, like any other nation, to decide who their citizens are. Not all tribal citizens are Native American. There are some tribes, for example, that accept black people as citizens who are the descendants of people who were enslaved by the tribe's members. So, you know, this is historically not been considered a racial classification. It's been considered a political classification. Are you a citizen of this nation? Are you eligible for citizenship in a tribal nation? And that is what triggers the law. And that's also why I think it would not be correct if the court ultimately determines that this is a statute that discriminates on the basis of race. Because, again, it does not say if a child is a Native American, they will be treated differently than a child of a different racial background. It says that if a child, you know, enjoys certain status vis-a-vis a particular tribal nation, then they will be treated differently.
We're talking with Ian Millhiser from Vox. The recent history of the Supreme Court's handling of Native American issues, what has that been like?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, with the exception of a brief period where Gorsuch and when there were four liberals plus Gorsuch, you know, the tribes tend to lose a lot of cases. This is not a court that has or at least the court's current majority has not shown a great deal of sympathy for the arguments made by the tribes and their lawyers. And certainly what we saw today was we saw four justices, the four Republican appointees who aren't Kavanaugh or rather who aren't Gorsuch or Barrett, did seem very skeptical of this law. I think there could be as many as four votes to strike down, you know, wide swaths of the law, if not the entire thing. But I do think that there was some uncertainty in this oral argument. I do think that, you know, Barrett has shown that she isn't going to vote with the most conservative members of the court 100% of the time in Indian Affairs cases. And so, I think the outcome in this case is uncertain, even though the court's current majority has frequently not been very friendly to the interests of, to the arguments made by tribes.
And if this law is overturned, could it have wider implications?
Potentially. I mean, certainly it would matter a lot for the cultures of, these various tribal nations. You know, the reason why this law exists is because for many years, the United States pursued a policy of taking children away from their families and basically teaching them to abandon their native culture and, you know, to behave more like white people. The states engaged in similar activities. And finally, Congress realized that a lot of these tribal nations would cease to exist for lack of people who share who are citizens of them and who share their culture. And so, there could be tremendous long-term implications for the future of Indian affairs in the United States. You know, I don't want to speculate too much about what the impacts could be beyond the context of Indian affairs because, you know, I need to read the opinion to know what it does.
Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, covering the Supreme Court. His story is at Vox.com and on Twitter, it's at iMillhiser. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oral argument today in that case, Holland v. Brackeen, and the decision from the court could come anytime between now and the end of the session, which is June or early July of next year. From CNN in London, British Cabinet Office Minister Gavin Williamson resigned from his role on Tuesday following recent allegations of bullying, saying the accusations against him were becoming a distraction for the good work this government is doing. In a resignation letter addressed to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, he wrote, "As you know, there is an ongoing complaint process concerning text messages I sent to a colleague. I am complying with this process, and I've apologized to the recipient for those messages. Since then, there have been other allegations made about my past conduct. I refute the characterization of these claims, but I recognize they're becoming a distraction for the good work this government is doing for the British people." Prime Minister Sunak accepted the resignation with great sadness, according to PA News Agency, and he wrote, "I would like to thank you for your personal support and loyalty." There was an exchange about all of this at today's Prime Minister's Questions in the British House of Commons in London. It begins with the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, everyone in the country knows someone like the member for South Staffordshire. A sad middle manager getting off on intimidating those beneath him. But everyone in the country also knows someone like the Prime Minister. The boss who is so weak, so worried the bullies will turn on him, that he hides behind them. What message does he think it sends when, rather than take on the bullies, he lines up alongside them and thanks them for their loyalty?
Mr. Speaker, the message that I clearly want to send is that integrity in public life matters. And that is why it is right that the Right Honourable Member has resigned. It is why it is right that there is a rigorous process to examine these issues. But as well as focusing on this one individual, it is also right and important that we keep delivering for the whole country. And that's why this government will continue to concentrate on stabilising the economy, on strengthening the NHS, and on tackling illegal migration. Those are my priorities. Those are the priorities of the British people, and this government will deliver on them.
Mr. Speaker, the problem is he can't stand up to a run-of-the-mill bully. So he has no chance of standing up to vested interests on behalf of working people.
British Labour Party leader Keir Starmer with the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who heads the Conservative Party, during Prime Minister's questions in the British House of Commons in London today. The Prime Minister has been in office for a few weeks, and his cabinet as well. And the cabinet minister who resigned was in that position for 14 days. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.